Donald Byrd with Slow Drag. I just love that song, so I played it again. It's been a while since I played it, but I just love that piano going dong, dong, dong as it starts out. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. Obviously, I'm vocally challenged. I will not make it in anybody's great choir. And I greet you from Florida, where at the Panhandle we have a hurricane developing, Category 4 so far, estimated at about between 130 to 145 miles an hour at this time, and expected to get even more ferocious. But I hate to be thankful that I'm not in that area, but I recognize that there's so many thousands of people who are, and who at this time are trying to scamper to safety, trying to figure out what to do, because the storm surge already in some areas is about 7 feet. That's a very dangerous sign when the water starts coming in this early. So we will get some rain, but nothing like the folks in the Panhandle are expected to get later on this evening and overnight, and certainly tomorrow. All right, we had talked about this speech by Senator Sheldon Whitehouse that he made on Monday to his colleagues in the U.S. Senate, and particularly those who sit on the Senate Judiciary Committee. And he talked about the unusual speed and how many procedures were avoided and cut and somehow manipulated to force through the nomination, and I should say the appointment eventually, of Brett Kavanaugh, who President Trump has said in celebrating the victory of his second appointee to the U.S. Supreme Court, declared that Kavanaugh had been through a rigorous examination and was found innocent. We didn't know that he was on trial as such. We knew that this was a hearing, and it was part of the procedures one assumes in getting an associate justice appointed to the U.S. Supreme Court. But according to Donald Trump, he was exonerated. He was found innocent, found to be innocent of all charges. But of course, it continues. The struggle continues because this was most unusual in any number of ways. When we listened to Senator Whitehouse on Monday, he did a very interesting overview about the depths to which many of the nation's allegedly hallowed institutions have sunk under Trump, and the desire by Trump to be all things. He's now president. He's also, it appears, heading up the FBI. He's making decisions across the board. He has removed people from their duties and taken them over himself. And it appears that he is now totally out of control. But the Democratic Party, and even within the Republican Party, within the ranks of the Republican Party, there are so many people unwilling to take him on, unwilling to express very deep concern about the conduct of the president and what he has done, the ravaging of institutions that were teetering on the brink anyway of caving in, from special interests and from the wealthy, and from political operatives who themselves looked to politics as a way to enrich themselves. So I thought it was a remarkable presentation. And what he talked about was that this appointment of Kavanaugh somehow came to, somehow brought all these very undesirable elements together in this shared, conjoined effort to create an entirely different America, one completely different from the one that we are accustomed to. And even so, we found many problems with these institutions. But now, according to Senator Whitehouse, the process of nominating Kavanaugh laid bare all of these incipient problems that somehow still managed to be camouflaged, and it's now totally out in the open. The question is, what will people do? What are we to do? What are people who oppose this kind of blanket corruption and the diminution in respect of these hallowed institutions, which, we have illusions that somehow they stand for something, or they stand between us and something even more pernicious and evil. But we could always comfort ourselves a little bit that at least we have something that stands in the name of upholding these tenets that we value as a nation. All that is pretty much torn asunder, says the senator. And now we are talking about what did we get out of his presentation? What does the landscape look like to you and me? And what are our choices that lay before us? Can we do anything to wrest control of an out of control presidency and an out of control country? So, this is where we headed today. We started the discussion. We did not have time to accommodate all of the calls that we got, but we certainly will be continuing with that discussion today. 888-874-4888 is the number to call. And I'd like you really to be as specific as you can about what you gleaned from his presentation, or if you didn't or weren't able to listen to it on your own, how do you interpret the moment that we are in as a so-called democratic society? What is the relationship between those who govern and those who are governed? What do you make of it? Is there any hope that that formula could be adjusted and quickly? What do you see? Where do you see us headed if we begin with this in this direction? Lisa, we weren't able to accommodate you yesterday, but here you are today. Thanks
Well,
for being with us.
that is quite all right. I was very excited. I didn't hear the entire speech yesterday. I wasn't sure who I was listening to until the end, but I was getting a little angry, and my first thought is that the speech was extremely partisan. And then when you mentioned the word partisan, now you may mean it in a different context as to what I heard. But I felt that this was a partisan speech on the part of Senator Whitehouse, maybe because elections are coming up. And I mean, I can be pretty specific. I do think one of the most important things that he did say was that there were witnesses who had asked to be interviewed during the three-day FBI investigation into the allegations of sexual misconduct against Christine Blasey Ford. So to me, that was a fact, and I thought that was important. But he also said that the Republicans were stopping at nothing to get this nominee through, and it just made me think, well, in 2016, the establishment Democrats were stopping at nothing to get their nominee through, namely Hillary Rodham Clinton. And I can go on and on, because I'm a progressive. I am not happy with the Republicans, and I'm not happy with the establishment Democrats. And you just said, where do we go from here? I think we need to get rid of these two parties.
Oh, great. That's a wonderful suggestion.
I mean, we need to stop acting as if these Democrats are our answer. You know, let's turn the part, you know, the Congress and the Senate blue. What does that do? I don't know, because to me, there was so much voter suppression during the 2016 Democratic primaries. We have, you know, Senator Whitehouse said, well, there are corporate interests. Corporate interests are the lifeblood of the Republican Party. I think they're the lifeblood of the Republican and the Democratic parties. And
absolutely.
I can't even watch.
We've been
watch
talking about that for quite some time here.
Yeah. Well, I love your show. I didn't realize you were on at 1 o'clock every day. I think I just realized that 2 weeks ago. So every day now I'm tuning in at 1 o'clock.
But how do we? I think you're quite right. I don't think anybody could sanely disagree with your position that both the Democrats and the Republicans have done this country and its people dirty with their political shenanigans. What do you think is within our power to do to change this?
I don't know, because, you know, I'm 64. I've been a lifelong Democrat. The last time I tried to help the Democrats was during the 2016 primary. I canvassed for Bernie Sanders. And at the end of that primary election, all of a sudden my eyes opened. I saw all the cheating that went on, all the votes that were changed, the people in Maricopa County, Arizona, who couldn't, you know, they were before these hearings and they couldn't get their votes cast, votes thrown out in California. And I all of a sudden I said to myself, you know, the Democrats aren't progressive, are they? And they really don't want progressive things for us. They don't want people like Bernie Sanders. They don't want us to have Medicare for all. They don't want us to have forgiveness of student loan debt. They're not dealing with police brutality. They're just not dealing with so many issues. And, you know, Senator Whitehouse also mentioned Republicans being polluters. Well, Hillary Clinton, as Secretary of State, had an office to promote fracking around the world. And Obama promoted fracking. And I just thought of this, but I don't know if your audience, if most people have seen Fahrenheit 11/9, but I didn't even know that Obama went to Flint, Michigan, and was so disrespectful to the population there about this poisoning of their city. The governor is still there, Rick Scott, and Obama bombed the city. I mean, not the people, but, you know, that movie shows that he went in there and just thought, well, these people are not that important. Let's do some military exercises here. And the people were not informed. They didn't know what was going on. I'm not a fan of Obama anymore. I voted for him twice, but I'm not a fan.
Well, you know, your sentiments are not just unique to you. So many people, more and more people, are exactly where you are.
I hope
they have become more definitive about why they dislike the system. But I'm not so sure that we have yet to see a cogent resistance, and on what basis will we come together in order to fight what we see as the coming together of the wealthy and the powerful against us. So I'm so glad that you were able to join us today, and thanks for calling in.
Well, thank you for your show.
Thank Bye-bye. You. Julie from New York, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello, Julie.
And hello to hi. I missed your show yesterday because I was at work, but I got up this morning and listened at 6 o'clock.
I'm glad that you did.
So, yeah, it was really interesting because after work I went to a meeting, and it was to meet someone through the independent voting group that I spoke about when I called before. Her name is Stephanie Miner, and she was a Democrat. She was a Democrat who was a rising star. She's a former mayor of Syracuse, New York. But she has just, she's become very disappointed and at how the system is broken and how it serves campaign contributors rather than the constituents, her constituents. So when I listened to that speech, I had written a few notes as an old-fashioned secretary. If I've got a pad and pencil nearby, I'll scribble something down. When you asked.
Old habits die hard, but they're very useful.
Yes, I wrote down 5-4 partisan decisions because that was very important because this, having gone last night to listen to this former Democrat that has just become so disappointed in the system, and what she said, a turning point, another phrase that he used that I wrote down is that the fire has been lighted. And she didn't use those terms, but she spoke about, as the prior caller mentioned, she spoke about the 2016 election and the thousands of young people that had become engaged and could not vote. And that's and several people there mentioned that. That's the fire that had been lit with them. So as I was listening to him, I thought about that after having listened to her last night, that this is what we can and it's what we have to do, because the independent voting movement is to create not a third party, but a third force. So there's a lot of activity going on now to do that. So that's what I'm working toward. And I'm much older, actually, than the caller that just referenced her age. So I have less time, but I'm doing what I can with the time that I have left.
How do you personally feel about, as you observe the transition that the country is going through?
Well, it's very disheartening to see, because now I realized how many years I was a mindless Democratic voter, I'll say. I was not well informed. And once your eyes are opened and you see everything the way it really is, it's infuriating in a way. I'm disappointed that I wasn't more knowledgeable sooner, but now I just believe I have to do what I can. And of course I'm involved with this independent movement because I believe we need to break this Democrat-Republican duopoly. So if I can live long enough to see that, that will be an accomplishment.
Thank you, Julie, for your call today, and thanks for your opinion. Thank you. David from Brooklyn, how are you? Haven't heard from you in a while.
You know, I did not hear the whole speech, but there are a few things I did hear. Today, it was mentioned democracy. As far as I can see, from the very beginning, with those so-called founding fathers, those slave masters and other people involved in forming the Constitution, to this day, this very day, it was not meant to be a democracy. It wasn't a democracy when it started, and it is not a democracy today. Because as I see it, this whole country is run by the rich and powerful. So, you know, when people say democracy, it's a question of tricking people and saying things enough times that are wrong, and eventually people start parroting and saying it over and over again that you have a democracy when there's no such thing here. This is a country run by the rich and powerful. The other thing that I did hear yesterday when the senator spoke, he spoke glowingly of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, you know, FBI. he wasn't really talking about what the FBI really is, which is a secret police organization, like the, you know, CIA and the a number of other intelligence groups. This is secret police. And when you think about the FBI's history in the suppression of the movement for civil rights, with Martin Luther King being surveilled by them, and the sabotage, even the murder of Fred Hampton in Chicago, and all the things that the FBI does, setting up people to make arrests for them as terrorists, when the FBI sets it up all for them and gets these hapless guys to go along. That's not an organization to be proud of. So, you know, that stuck with me. But I think the most important thing, as I see it, people have to get to the point where they're not now, where they understand that this is a place that is run by the few for the benefit of that few. The people in those organizations like the Congress and the political parties, with the Democrat and Republican parties, they all work for those who are running them, and that's the people at the very top. They run the whole place, and they play with you and tell you to go out and vote for one or the two. I mean, this is ridiculous. People have to get it together and really start looking at this and understanding how this whole place is running.
Could you identify one workable idea that would come as close as we can get it? It's not going to be perfect. I'm not asking for the perfect answer, but as a pragmatic answer to what is going on now.
Yes, I would say one idea. There are lots of things, but we have to get it so that it would be illegal to give so-called, quote-unquote, campaign contributions. There should be no payment to people running for office in this country. I mean, we need a different system. And we need to take control of the things that belong to the people, like the airwaves, and not allow them to charge people huge fees to get to advertising on the radio and television and so forth. So the candidates would not be allowed to take any money from private individuals, corporations, or individuals. I said that's a possible thing that we could do. So that would be one thing. You know, your question, one thing. Well, that's what I, one of the things that I would start with. And so, you know, that would be, I think, a significant thing.
It sounds like a very good idea and something that should be explored much further. Thanks so much, David, for your call today. I'm glad to hear your voice.
Thank you.
Thanks. Julie from New York. Oh, we got Julie already. John from New Jersey. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hello.
I hope you're doing well. You sound well.
Yeah, I'm hanging in. Thank
Good.
You.
That seems to be the response whenever anyone asks that question. I'm hanging in there. By my fingernails, but I'm hanging in.
Yes.
You know, the woman that spoke before said that she no longer, felt good about President Barack Obama, which reminded me of a question that I ask a lot of people right out of the gate when we start to talk about politics, and that is, the question is, who do you believe is the two greatest Republican presidents we've ever had, barring Abe Lincoln? You know, and people look at me quizzically and blah, blah, blah. And then I tell them, in my opinion, the two greatest Republican presidents we've ever had was Bill Clinton and Barack Obama. If you look at the legislation and the things that they allowed to go on while they were in power, you would have to say it's hands down, all of their policies were strong Republican corporate policies. So, to me, they're traitors, as simple as that. And I don't know what else to say about it other than to keep saying it until more people start to think the way that I think about it. Other than that, you know, and like I said, I'm hanging in there by my fingernails, like a lot of people I know. Even people who are well-to-do are very concerned about what's going on. It's just a runaway train. And the middle class and the poor in America are the passengers on that runaway train. So
I'll ask you the question that I asked David. Do you have any suggestion as to what could work
as a way of opposing this? That's on my question list too. The way I answer that is I say, what do you think that we should do to make our government work better? And of course, the answer to that is finance campaign reform. That's the answer. And the fact that people who get caught doing things wrong, I don't care, if they're Lehman Brothers or what have you, if they get caught ripping off this country, they should be sent directly to the tombs, you know, just like everyone else who's poor and gets arrested because they're hungry. It's a sorry, sorry state of affairs. I remember when President Obama made his first speech, and he said, when he said the phrase, "I'm only interested in looking forward," you know, I called up my friend immediately and I said two words, Tony, and he said, "Sold out." And that's what they're all doing. I love John Cleese, the guy from Monty Python, who's a hero of mine, I must say. And Bill Maher said to him, "What do you think the problem is?" And he said simply, "Everyone." And he said again, "Everyone is lying," and that's what we're up against: perpetual lying, just like the fascists did. You know, the famous line about tell a lie, make it big, and just keep on telling it, you know. And you look at the major disasters that have happened in our country within the past, let's say 15 years, because that's around when 9/11 happened, you would think that, this is a trend, and it continues to go on, and the public are becoming even more and more misinformed about what's going on. I mean, just because you paint the helmets white doesn't mean they're good guys, you know? You think we'd have learned that already by now. But I'm not running out of things to say, but I don't want to take up the whole show. I know there's a lot of people that need
Thank
that.
You, John. Thank you very much for your contribution today.
And you hang in there, too.
Thank you so much. Jeff from New Jersey, what are your thoughts on the subject?
Well, I think one of the things that we really have to do is again, examine some of these things that happened. For instance, the election of Donald Trump. Greg Palast has a thing, a documentary, the best democracy money can buy. And it shows that the numbers were there for Hillary, but through some messing with the voting machines, you know, getting people off of the voting rolls, that they were able to capture the election. So the first thing we need to do as people is make sure that we have one vote per person and that those votes count. We need to go back to paper ballots and make sure that paper ballots and maybe some other form of counting how many people go in and match them up against how many votes were actually cast. Then we need to go and the lifeblood of our civilization, lifeblood of our I don't say culture, I don't know, but our lifeblood is our news. Our lifeblood is our information. And we need to be able to put together things alternative of the media. I know that a lot of people are discouraged about people not saying this or not hearing about this or not doing this. But in my job, I was able to talk to a lot of people from a lot of different places. And I think people are a lot more aware and they're a lot more in tune than we're actually getting to find out. Because if we have five companies dominating 90% of the media, they're going to give us the narrative they want. They're not going to talk about the, you know, 800,000 people marching in, you know, or 80,000 marching in North Carolina for about voting rights, et cetera, et cetera. So things are out there, but we need to create our own network. We need to create our own bloodline.
But these things notwithstanding, and they do have merit in terms of how they can influence change. I want to ask you the question, to direct your answer to the question of whether there's change at ground level or mid-level. What Senator Sheldon Whitehouse was talking about was the fact that the system itself is rigged, and rigged in ways that ordinary people obviously would have an extraordinary, almost impossible time in trying to change. What do you think about that?
I think he is, and I don't think it's an impossible, and I don't think it's that extraordinary. I think it's some hard work, but I don't think it. I think we can change it. But and I think it, the my opinion is that we change it by again creating that base where we have a base of communication, that we all have these ideas that we'll be able to share and be able to see other folks, because I think that changes the attitude. As far as it changes the attitude as far as people's perspective, their thoughts about having it change. And if you can think about having it change, and you can achieve it. My thing is, with this system, we have to create an alternate system, something that we control. We control our school boards. We control our local government. And if we can do something in the local government, you know, for instance, if there's an ordinance on fracking, that no fracking will occur in this county or in this town, if there's a line of towns that have that, a line of towns throughout the state that have that ordinance, guess what? You can't frack in that state. The state may allow it, but if your municipality does not allow it, then you can avoid the fracking. And I think that's the same thing with all of these, what the national level of politics can do to affect the local level of politics. And that's where we need to begin. If we can begin at the local level of politics to combat, like you're talking about, the judges in the local level, well, we have the mayors and people who appoint these local judges. You know, we have the county seats who may appoint these local judges. We can serve on a jury. to make sure, and that's what I'm thinking, you know, I talk about black folks sometimes, oh, I'm not going to jury duty, and then you complain about the jury being all white against a black defendant and finding, a, you know, an unjust verdict. If we participate in these things and we get involved in these things, then we have a say. Those are things that are within our hands. Those are things that are within our power. So when he's talking about the national politics, yes, no, we can't walk into the Senate and make them change or, you know, influence the people who are getting paid all this money. No, but we can influence what we can on this level. From that, it grows. You can't do anything without creating a good base. So right now, we have to give the top, give to Caesar what is Caesar's. But we have to take what is ours on the bottom. This way, when we build that base, it will be a domino effect. You know, we can keep pushing up. That's a little pyramid effect, which we, you know, build layer upon layer until we can get the type of leadership or the type of legislation, the type of whatever we need, justice in the country. But we have to start at the base. And this was kind of my idea about having Donald Trump and all his confusion. People, you know, in and out of his administration, he's doing it. They're still getting some things done. But he is in such chaos that it allows us to organize.
But you know, organizing, as especially as you describe it, is a function of time.
Yes.
Do we have the luxury of that much time?
We got 2 years. Right now, we got 2 years to try to get the stuff. And I don't think we're that far off. There are a bunch of groups out there that are probably doing things in a political sense, in a progressive sense, in an ecological sense. We just need to coordinate them. And the one thing we are, we're disjointed because we don't have, you know, what, you look on TV, what station, what network is talking about climate change? None. What network is talking about Yemen? None. But there are people out there that are protesting, that are putting these things together. If we can find a way to coordinate, and this is the blessing of Progressive Radio Network, they're one of those places where people can come and get the news sources, get the day-to-day, right? But we don't know how many of us are out there. That's the problem. There are a lot of us out there, and I'm saying from my conversations, there are a lot of people who are very, very aware of the pharmaceutical industry, of the global warming, of people spraying people. I would not think, you know, I said, well, you know, I have vision problems, so I said, what color is the sky today? Oh, it's gray. You know, they're spraying that stuff up in the air again. People you would never, never think that had that kind of, that would pay attention to those things. But we are here. We're getting more and more aware as a people. So we just need a way to connect the dots. You know, we need a way to communicate with each other and come together. The people are there. Majority of the people are good. There's not that many people that voted. There's a good number of people that voted for Trump. There are definitely much more people that voted against him. They just were not allowed. 75,000 votes between Detroit and Flint, Michigan, were eliminated alone. Hillary Clinton lost Michigan by 10,000 votes. And it was because of vote. They said the voting machine wouldn't register the vote. So, you know, we have to get hit to the game, but all at the same. We got a lot of things to do at one time. But
well, thank you for offering your opinion, and let's hope people react to it. You put a lot on the table to be considered. Thank you so much for calling in. Marcus from Wisconsin, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, Ms. Leeds. Always a pleasure speaking with you. I enjoy your program so very much.
Me too.
thank you.
I get to meet great people like you.
I'd like to preface this with some facts that the media has completely ignored left or right in the United States. Every 2 years, the Department of Education does a very good study on international educational levels of the adult population, not the student population, in the 39 OECD countries, the Office of Economic Development and Cooperation, which we fancy is the developed world because we have automobiles and computers and cheese-flavored dog food and stuff. So in the 2017 study, which was the latest one, internationally recognized study, the U.S. population finished dead last in numeracy. We're the worst with numbers in the developed world. Little British school kids are better than we are. And 35th out of 39 in literacy. Now, this was an intentional campaign from both parties over many years to bring this about. So when you listen to people's orientation about how to, quote, change things, they are always referencing something historically that has not worked. The electoral political system, religion, celebrity worship, complete nonsense. This political system is a dead end for anybody but the rich. It was controlled by the rich. It was set up by rich aristocrats in order to nullify any decisions population may be allowed to make if the rich don't like it. So the idea that you're going to get, you know, somebody into this structure and make it serve you is the very worst kind of delusion. This is why people like Obama gave you little bromides to go nuts over, like hope. Hope is indistinguishable from prayer. It leads to no action. Even modest political goals, like say you want to, get a rise in the minimum wage. The largest rise in the minimum wage ever in U.S. history was, I believe it was 1968 or 69. I think 69. It went up a dollar something an hour. Huge in comparison to any of the other rises in the minimum wage. Cities were burning from coast to coast because that's what it takes to get even modest little victories out of this system. And don't forget it. You are Bernie Sanders, when he announced his campaign, told you flat out that he was going to sell you out. He said, if I don't win, I'll endorse whoever the Democrat nominee is. Well, that tells you right there he's not serious. But did our 35th out of 39 in literacy population figure this out? Of course they didn't. Now, this is the problem. The problem is whatever system you set up is owned by the rich. Until you put a cap, a serious cap on wealth, you know, the last politician I can remember in U.S. history talking about it was Huey Long, and he got it too. Now, look.
So let me ask you. I mean, you've given us a pretty well-rounded view.
Thanks.
But you haven't gotten close to what you think might work.
What will work is an example that I gave you about the minimum wage. Now, burning cities is not the only way to do it, but it starts with action outside the political system. If you don't like the kind of fuel you're dependent on, get together with your neighbors and find another way to do it. If you don't like the educational system, get together with your neighbors and set up something else. The Bolivarian Revolution in Venezuela, by the way, which was very successful under Chavez, used what they called Bolivarian neighborhood circles. This is a very old idea. It's ancient, in fact. If there are people in your neighborhood that can't read and write, and you can set up a way to teach them to read and write. Do not depend on institutions to do it, because once they do it, they'll make sure it doesn't happen. You see what I'm saying? You have to actually organize different structures and take part in them and then stop participating in the tyrannical structures that are given to you by the rich. This is the principle. It's not an individual set of actions. It's a principle that has to be absorbed.
But as I said to several callers previous to your call, we're talking about the function of time. And this has been a major problem in getting people to understand that these changes, especially enumerated the way you have, the ways that you think things could work, it takes time. And the people most in need of change they don't have too much time. And the time that they have is to be directed toward literally life and death survival issues.
Oh, yes.
So how do you cope with all of this? Give me one idea that you think might work where people who are struggling against a mighty system and with some idea of what could work instead, how do you make them embrace the idea despite the opposition that they should proceed and do so without fear? Because in the end, these are things that are accomplishable.
I would quibble with one part of your premise, which is that it's necessary in order to convince a lot of people to go along with it at first. People, I've done teaching over many years off and on, and if I've learned anything, it's that people do not learn from preaching, doctrine, or dogma. They learn from example. They will look at what's in front of them, and if they dig it, they'll get with it. And if they don't, they'll avoid it. And Americans are very, very basic about it. If they see that something is going to empower them, to use a modern term, they will follow it. So you just had a caller talking about communication, a very general term we throw around without ever defining what it means. Okay, we need an alternative media system that is not controlled by corporations, by banks and insurance companies who control the political system. So, okay, how do you do that? There is a community television and radio station in virtually every community who uses it. Usually the flakes, right? Well, it's right there. It's in place. There are qualified technical people. You go down there and you say, I'd like to do a television program on this subject, on the hungry kids in my neighborhood. And they will help you do it. They will make sure you have a camera crew and audio people and production people. Who does it? No, Americans don't do it because they're trained to, over many generations, instead of educating themselves, to sit in front of a screen and do what they're told. In fact, they don't even have to be told anymore. They clamor to get the screens so they can follow them around. Now, this is the problem. The problem is not the political system. It's the population. You've got to grow up. You've got to get emotionally mature. Most Americans, even worse than their educational levels, is the fact that they have the emotional maturity of five-year-olds. Any kind of a challenge and they collapse. Well, if it can't be done instantly, there's no point in doing it. Patience, loyalty, concepts like honor among working people, it's just vacant. It's not there. This is the problem. it's the population. They are decadent. And they have to realize it and raise themselves up. You know, I spent a lot of time as a little kid with my grandfather, who was born in 1889. He was part of the pre-World War I generation. And to him, strength was defending somebody who was defenseless. To this generation, exploiting someone who is defenseless is being manly, is being adult. It's just common sense. It's just good business, or what Americans like to call pragmatism. Educated Americans, especially progressives, love to blather about pragmatism, which is, if everybody believes it, it must be true. Now, this is the mental concept of a slave.
Well, you know, the good thing that I have heard from callers today,
mm-hmm,
is that more and more people are not thinking that way. There is an emerging constituency that is prepared or preparing to go another route, taking a chance, even that some things will not work. But they are seeing the light that even if things, you take a chance at things, you know, hopefully will not fail if you put in the right amount of energy in it, but mm-hmm, that there is still a groundswell of opposition and that people are coming to terms with it on their own. This is a remarkable thing, and we can't discount the importance of that.
Oh,
well,
no,
we've come to the end of our program today. I want to thank you so much, everyone who called. I think this is the greatest program on the planet. Why? Because we're talking to each other. You don't have to be right. You don't have to be wrong. We just have to ask each other the questions. And together, we can figure out something that would work. Marcus was just talking about local community television stations. I was fortunate enough to be on the ground floor of one of these stations in Brooklyn. And the sad story is I could not convince enough people to sign up and register and take the courses that were totally free to help them become efficient at being community reporters. I just couldn't do it. They wanted to produce programs that had no meaning, that took up time on the air, but didn't really convey any material that was useful to the community. It was very disappointing. But, you know, you have to be prepared for disappointments, and you still have to keep moving. So that's the challenge. We are collectively in a place where we don't enjoy being. We don't want to be in the place we're in today as a nation, as a community. The question is, what can we do together to direct the traffic elsewhere and to invest our energy in issues and in actions that benefit the group as a whole? Thanks so much for tuning in today. We join each other again tomorrow, right here at prn.fm. Thanks so much for listening.